With cyber attacks on the rise, protecting your data security is more important than ever. So why is Congress considering a bill that puts your credit card data at greater risk of being hacked and exposed to foreign networks? The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill shifts billions in consumer spending to less secure payment networks, all so that corporate megastores can make bigger profits. Don't let Durbin-Marshall steal your data. Visit electronicpaymentscoalition.org and tell your senators to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This might be the wildest one we've covered.
Michael Bosey, he got shot down in New Guinea, and they never found the body because there used to be a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
He takes this very seriously. His uncle, who served and protected this country, lost his life serving.
How dare you?
And people would be like, well, there's, you know, if you cut this and you cut that and you cut that, you know, it really starts adding up. And it's like, yeah, I get it. But like, we spend more on Social Security in this country in a month than we've spent in the entire Ukrainian war.
For conservatives who want to shut down the border, maybe they, if they would have stuck together and pushed just one or two of those things that realistically could have become law, they would have succeeded.
We have Zionists.
We have Zionists.
Who have entered the camp.
Who have entered the camp.
It's like Fight Club meets Revenge of the Nerds. Total sheep, but also super dorky.
Seize the endowments. Yeah. Of these places. Mm-hmm. Seize the endowments.
This is the farm system for the future of the Democratic Party.
This is it.
Radical, and it's crazy, and it's pro-Hamas.
And dope the horses, dope the athletes. And like I said, this should be just phase one. This is going to work well.
What's phase two?
Phase two is now you have the super athletes, you breed them. And then you have like you know, superhumans that are now competing for our entertainment, you know?
So we get on the media, and I was like, Ruthless Podcast.
Yes!
That's right.
And they were like, really? I was like, first thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please.
Just a catch of strays over here.
You're in for a hell of a show.
Keep the faith. Hold the line and own the libs.
It's time for our main.
Welcome back to the Ruthless Variety program. Good Tuesday to you, gentlemen, and all of our listeners. We've got a big week in front of us. We've got a big guest here today.
That's right.
I think one of them, like, you don't hear a lot from because he's doing a job, right? And in today's day and age, when you're doing a job, you got to do the job. You can't just talk about the job. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about RNC chair Michael Whatley, former North Carolina chair.
Yeah, good man.
Smug. You will love that interview that we've got here today. You're going to hear a lot of new stuff, a lot of things that are critically important to winning. How about that as an interesting function?
I mean, it's a good idea, right? And he has had a tremendous, tremendous track record in North Carolina. Great interview.
Yeah, and talking about the blocking and tackling of how elections are won.
Yep.
You know, how do you set up a voter integrity unit? Like, you know, how do you work with the apparatus in a state to figure out what the rules of the road are and how does that impact your strategy for how you're going to win in November? And getting started early, stuff that like the people here on this panel are familiar with because we've run elections. But for our audience, I think it's critically important to hear from a guy like this.
I was reliably told you just hired Sidney Powell. Is that not it?
Yeah, you don't just get to complain afterwards.
That's not how it works.
No, turns out that's not how it works.
Oh, I'm critically disappointed. Well, we've got a whole bunch of stuff coming up. The first thing we have to get to, if you missed this last week, this might be the wildest one we've covered. And you know how we like to lead the show with Biden or Kamala and whatever? We got a little different format, as you've noticed, but we're still going to keep with the motif. By playing you clip number one. Spaghetti, can we cue this up?
And my uncle, they called him Ambrose Brosey, they called him Bosey. My uncle Bosey was a hell of an athlete, they tell me, when he was a kid. And he became an Army Air Corps before the Air Force came along. He flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea. And they never found the body because there used to be a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
Type beast.
So, I mean, you know, we've already done the.
You know, this is This is actually the first time I've seen that video. I've read all the stories. I've read all the reactions. I've not seen that video yet.
It's the earnestness by which it's conveyed that really gets me.
And if you are only an audio listener, you've never been to YouTube before, I highly recommend you watch that clip on YouTube, because Biden spends the first 10 seconds of it with his eyes closed.
Yeah, it's like he's conjuring up the memory. it's the painful past. He tries to repress on a daily basis, but now today, he'll share it with all of us.
The audience is back is like trying to nod along, being like, "Yeah, bro's uncle is eaten by cannibals."
Like, imagine having to be like one of those like paid volunteers or whatever, holding up the steel workers for Biden sign behind as he's telling one of these barn burner stories. You know,
well, it was bad enough when he went through the litany of different cultures he was brought up in.
Right,
right. Yeah. I mean, he was like Portuguese and Indian.
He is raised in a synagogue in Puerto Rico and you name it.
And part of the black church and all of those things. And then now he's got family that were cannibalized, evidently. Well, our good friend over
there. Bozy.
Old Bozy.
They could never find the body.
Old Bozy got eaten up.
this puts a new spin on putting the meat at the front of the program. Right?
That's exactly right. Well, our good friend Peter Ducey over at Fox News took some exception to this. Hadn't heard this story before, as we had. So he decided to check up on it in clip number two, Spaghetti.
Why is President Biden saying he was shot down? There's no evidence of that. And why is he saying that his uncle was eaten by cannibals? That is a bad way to go.
He lost his life. It's not, look, we should not make jokes about
it's
this.
It's not. President Biden said that his uncle was eaten by cannibals.
I mean, your last line, it's for a laugh. It's for a funny statement.
It was funny.
And he takes this very seriously. His uncle, who served and protected this country, lost his life serving.
I love it. They just turn it into that.
How dare you? It was for a laugh. What? Ducey's thing was for a laugh? Because it wasn't Biden that was for a laugh. I mean, although it's very funny.
It's very funny that he just makes things up. Yeah, that is very funny.
There's no evidence of any of it. That is the best part. So according to the New York Post, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, do you want to give that a run, Smash?
Karine Jean-Pierre.
She acknowledged on Thursday that Biden's maternal uncle, Ambrose Finnegan, actually died when his plane went into the Pacific during World War II, and he wasn't eaten by cannibals, as Biden, and they say implied. I think that's gratuitous, because it wasn't implied so much as absolutely.
He said straight up, they didn't find the body because there was an island full of cannibals. It's like, what's our takeaway from that? Maybe it drifted off into the ocean? Like,
what's the point of protecting him like that? You know? I mean, why do you... I don't know.
What can you come up with? I mean, look, if this is the trajectory that we're going, I mean, it's April.
Yeah.
It's April. And we've seen all the crazy shit that he's said up to this point and things that he's made up about his own biographical history and everything else. Like, if we're clearing cannibals in April, like, what's this look like in September? I mean,
I don't know. He's going to be saying 9/11 was an inside job. Like, I don't know.
or like, he was on the plane
in
9/11 and brought it down in Pennsylvania.
Bro.
I mean, that's the thing is, like, the number of times that he has fabricated his life, his stories. I was raised in a black church. I was raised in a synagogue. And beyond that, he uses tragedy. This is the whole thing. It's like, you know, people try to portray him. Oh, it's good old Grandpa Biden. You know, he's a nice guy. He has used tragedy for his personal gain so many times. He says, like, oh, you know, my son died in Iraq. My son died fighting Bin Laden. My son, you know, he's made up stories about his dead son.
I know.
He's made up stories now about his dead uncle. Like, there's nothing this guy won't make up on the spot to make people try and like it.
Have you ever seen the movie Hidden Figures about the women who helped NASA, scientists? Did you know that Dr. Jill Biden was one of the original scientists, the Hidden Figures?
Dr. Jill was Susan B. Anthony. I don't know if you knew that.
She was.
I don't know if you knew that.
Don't try to pretend she wasn't. Don't laugh. It's not a funny line.
It's not funny. There's nothing to laugh about, fellas. In other news, an equally comical charade happening in New York during Trump's hush money trial. And you've probably seen a lot about this just on your cable news, just because people are reporting and it's live video and this, that, and the other thing. But what has occurred to me, basically, at the top, they've picked the jury, first of all.
Yep.
Which, in and of itself, I mean, an amazing thing that you can find these people that are ready to judge one way or another, despite a long voting history and everything against this guy, that these people are fair and impartial. But I think they've done the best that they can. Anyway, that was all last week. Now you're talking about some of the arguments that are happening. I want to read to you a handful of headlines here. None of this was a crime, defense attorney says. Yep, that checks out because the as we've reported here on the Variety program, the U.S. attorney declined to prosecute that. Second, it was election fraud, pure and simple, prosecutor says. Now that one's my favorite. Election fraud. That's not what this case is.
Nope.
No one has alleged election fraud. In fact, the only thing that was butted up against elections at all was the allegation against Michael Cohen that was made that he paid hush money to Stormy Daniels at the behest of Donald Trump in order to conceal it from the public. Facts that were laid out years ago. And a U.S. attorney investigated and decided we don't have anything to prosecute the president on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so this guy, as you've talked about a lot, right, Dunks?
Yeah.
Decided, well,
I'm going to take a misdemeanor. I'm going to slice it up 40 ways and make it felonies.
Despite the fact that the underlying crime that makes it a felony was failed, nobody ever prosecuted.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, it's a real underpants gnomes investigation here.
But it tells you a lot about the direction that they're headed on this, right? It's not about proving the facts of the case, as one typically does during a trial. They're trying to illuminate this larger discussion that they know they've already got bought and sold with a New York Manhattan jury, which is election fraud.
Yep.
Right? Next headline. Trump hears differing views of his personality. What's that have to do with it? Right? Judge scolds Trump for muttering at prospective juror.
That's my favorite one.
First of all, that's the price of admission. If you're in that jury box, you have to admit deep down somewhere you wanted to get some of this.
A little muttering.
Right? Like, you knew that this was going to be something that was inextricably change your life, but at least you get a little comic relief out of it.
Yeah.
It feels like that can't be discouraged. next headline, judge sets hearing on Trump for holding him in contempt. So this is the part where, you know, in a typical jury trial, a judge gives instructions to a defendant not to speak publicly about what's happening and certainly not about any of the individuals or jurors or anything else in the case. Now, just so happens that this is a Republican nominee for president of the United States, a former president. He's in a court of public opinion at the same time that he's in a judicial court. And so people are attacking him. Defense attorneys prosecuting attorneys are going out all the time, maligning his character, doing this, that, and the other thing, trying to obtain a conviction, and based on the headlines I just read, on issues that are unrelated to the trial itself, and yet they're holding Trump to a standard where he can't speak at all.
Well, it's almost like that was the plan all along. They're like, why won't you let us use lawfare to besmirch you during campaign season? Just shut up. Don't reply. Don't try to talk about your innocence. Don't tell your side of the story. We need our Democrat, you know, a lot of them took Soros money. Prosecutors and district attorneys who ran on prosecuting you to have their side of the story told only. Like, this is the most blatantly political BS ever.
It's a safe space for them. It's a safe space, and if Trump violates their safe space by saying something, that really upsets these people.
But just
he's not allowed to talk.
Just in case you were living in a cave and you didn't understand the political nature of this and you didn't listen to Andy McCarthy and people like that on this program and others, and thought this was not a political process, that this was entirely about the law in New York. Those headlines and what is being argued should dispel you of all of that.
Yep.
They're talking about election. This has nothing to do with an election. Not one count has anything to do with an election.
No, it's falsifying business records.
Yes.
And what they're alleging is that's in service of this other crime, a crime which, as we've said here, was not prosecuted by DOJ.
No.
So it's like, it's remarkable.
But also, like, none of the other charges, whether it's a document case, whether it's the Jan 6 case, where it's, you know, all the other things that he's dealt with, nobody's charged him with election fraud.
Right.
Nobody's charged Donald Trump with election fraud. And this guy says it's election fraud, pure and simple, prosecutor says. Okay. Well.
You know, did you guys see what Jonathan Turley said about this case last week? right at the very beginning. He said they took a dead misdemeanor, they attached it to a dead alleged federal felony, and zapped it back into life. Many of us are just amazed to watch this thing actually walk into court because it's not a recognizable crime.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Man, it's well said. Very well said. So we're going to stay up on that just so you know what's going on. We don't need to delve too deeply at it. You know, this is not what we do.
I'm not Nancy Grace.
Well, no, but you... You could be.
I think I could.
Yeah, you maybe could be. But coming up on Ruthless, we're get into the details of that big aid package that passed the House over the weekend. I know there's a lot of big feelings on both sides of that. And then we'll talk a little bit about the Hamas rallies, because as we know, there's a constituency for that within the Democratic Party. It's playing out on college campuses and Columbia in particular. Mm-hmm. We also have, I don't know if you guys have watched this. The NYPD and the FDNY.
I heard about this.
So, like, annually they play this hockey game. Mm-hmm. And they're, first of all, they're pretty good at hockey. But second of all, they fight like the Dickens. I mean, that seems to be the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we've got a clip we got to show, and we'll react to all that. You're going to love everything. And then we'll obviously get to our big interview with RNC Chair Michael Whatley here at the end of the show. With all that, we'll be back right after this.
Americans for Prosperity has done it again. You're going to love this. Know how Biden's been running around the country bragging about Bidenomics? And the media's doing stories on how the president has embraced the term? Well, guess what? Americans for Prosperity just bought the Bidenomics.com domain name. I can't believe the White House didn't get this first. This would be like Pepsi buying Coca-Cola.com. It's hilarious. Bidenomics.com sets the record straight on the failures of Joe Biden's economy, his horrible record on cost of living, wages, debt, deficits, energy, and more. I've been to the site. I can tell you, it's not what Joe Biden wants Americans to see. AFP takes Biden's own words and compares them to the reality of everyday Americans. It's packed with facts and stories that prove Bidenomics is a costly failure. Americans for Prosperity deserves a lot of credit for this coup. Visit Bidenomics.com soon, the website Joe Biden doesn't want you to see.
So, it has been since mid-February when the Senate passed this foreign aid package that, of course, dealt with Ukraine funding, Israel funding, and Taiwan funding. Mm-hmm. And the significance of that wrapped all together is there are different constituencies for each. The pro-Ukrainian side, in particular, has seen the Taiwan space as interconnected. In that the argument goes that if Putin were to roll through Ukraine, given the alliances that Xi has made with Putin over this, it sends a message to Xi that apparently the Western world doesn't have the stomach to kind of stop anything that's of significance internationally, despite what they talk about. And so Taiwan is sort of next on the block. That has been a piece of the puzzle. That's why it's included in there. Interestingly enough, as this discussion has progressed, and late last week, Speaker Johnson included a TikTok ban, which, of course, passed the House of Representatives widely, a huge bipartisan vote a few weeks ago, into that piece because it's directly targeting China.
Right.
They wrapped all of that piece up. The Taiwan piece passed 385 to 34 to 1. There was one person who voted present, Tlaib.
Hmm.
She's, as we know, we take our directives in international affairs directly from the chairman of the Hamas
caucus.
Yeah. The Israel piece passed 366 to 58. I was a little bit surprised, honestly, that it got 58 opposition. But if you look at the 37 Democrats that opposed it, you're dealing with a constituency there that, again, very much a part of the Hamas constituency. Mm-hmm. And the 21 Republicans that oppose, I think a vast majority of those, if not all of them, kind of think we shouldn't do any kind of foreign aid at all, right? This is a very libertarian sect of the Republican electorate, and most of them are pretty consistent on it. The Ukraine piece passed 311 to 112. All 112 opposition was on the Republican side. 101 Republicans supported it. But overall, you're dealing with a package that passed with over 300 votes on everything. And of course, the backdrop to all of that was, again, your libertarian segment of the Republican House conference threatening to vacate the chair over any vote on this. Fellas, you've been watching this. Like, what do you think?
Well, I mean, to me, this seems kind of like an argument where you're not going to be able to get any progress done, because I understand the sentiment, and I think it's the right sentiment of how are we going to defend every country's borders but our own? But the thing is, this administration with Joe Biden and a Senate majority is not going to do anything about the border. They're going to try and act like they're doing something about the border. They've wanted an open border. There was even an admission a couple of weeks ago from Joe Biden that he's going to do some executive orders, which he repealed when Trump had them in place to secure the border.
Still haven't seen any of that, by the way. Yeah. That was several weeks ago.
Again, it's just they're going to act and say that they're doing something about the border. But they won't, and nothing will be done until we have a Republican president, until Donald Trump wins. So that's the crux of the issue, is we can't have the secure our own border part while Biden is in the White House and Democrats control the Senate. That's just what it comes down to me.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the Ukraine piece, which I think in the Republican Party was obviously the most divisive in all of this. You know, what I thought was most interesting, and these sort of things grind my gears. You know how?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Let's get them lined up.
You know, I don't really care whether you support it or oppose it, but what really irks me in politics is when people make fake arguments.
Yeah.
You know, and what I heard from a lot of folks, those libertarianish Republicans who are like, you know, we shouldn't fund this, is like, this is really bad for the debt, you know, which, okay, I can understand you don't like the spending and all that sort of thing, but come on, like, act like this is the thing that is going to tip the scales, that we're finally going to be, you know, financially insolvent as a country.
Well, it's all
like,
goes to the facade that irks us more than anything else, which is the idea that is propagated in campaigns throughout this country that I'm going to balance the budget, I'm going to cut foreign aid.
Yeah. It's just like it's not true.
It's a teardrop in the ocean of your problem.
Like just make the argument that we shouldn't be funding this war in Ukraine. That would be an honest argument. And I can think of a lot of reasons why it's a good argument. Like, we haven't been a lot of progress over there in a long time. It looks like a stalemate with nobody really moving anywhere. And like, what is this funding going to do to ultimately help Ukraine, like, actually win the war and regain their territory? Is that even possible? I haven't seen the security briefings. I haven't been in the rooms.
Right.
This is why we elect people to represent us in Congress. Mm-hmm. And I hope they can figure it out. But like, that's a genuine argument.
Right,
like, yeah. Complaining about the national debt and being like, we can't send money to Ukraine because of our debt, is, I just think it's like such like a facile argument.
Well, it is. Right?
It just is. And people would be like, well, there's, you know, if you cut this and you cut that and you cut that, it, you know, it really starts adding up. And it's like, yeah, I get it. But like, we spend more on Social Security in this country in a month than we've spent in the entire Ukrainian war.
You spend more on interest in a month than you spend on the entire Ukrainian war.
Right.
And by interest, I mean the actual accrual of interest on what you're paying because you've already borrowed that money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm fine with you being like, I don't want to fund Ukraine. But just be honest that, like, you just don't think they could win the war and you don't think this money will help. That's an honest argument. The debt thing is not an honest argument.
And then come back to us with the debt argument.
Right.
Because I'd love to hear one. I haven't heard one in a while. I'm open for business on that.
Yeah.
I'm open for business. Smash.
I mean, a lot's been said about the Ukraine thing. If you're looking at 300 and something votes, it's a kind of bill that was always going to pass. And so the question is, what do you get in exchange for that? And for Republicans who wanted to send money to Ukraine, wanted to send money to Israel, wanted to send money to Taiwan, wanted all of those things, they got what they wanted. But for conservatives who want to shut down the border or do something to get the border to get the Border Patrol a little bit more money, or to crack down on some of these like loose asylum laws.
Yeah.
maybe they, if they would have stuck together and pushed just one or two of those things that realistically could have become law, they would have succeeded.
Mm. Yeah.
And we would have had something that's just a little bit better. Maybe well, one less
realistically
SWAT
can
team
become
from
law
Senegal.
Is the key component to your argument on that, because you're right.
It's dude, not it's not going to solve all, Donald Trump becoming president and shutting down the border is the only thing that's going to stop the open border. But what can we do between now and then to slow the flow?
It's a really good point. Like I hope listeners really got that, because it's a crucial part of this is that that wound for conservatives is a self-inflicted wound. When that Lankford bill came out, and hate it or love it, like not working with that in the context of something that could actually pass, we gave up all of our leverage. And so what you're left with is a foreign aid bill.
And I think we said it at the time. And look, at what we said at the time was actually figure out the arguments rather than what's happening in terms of cable news at the time. Like, look into it and figure out whether or not reducing maximum flow to 3,000 before you implement an immediate shutdown of the border is not progress.
Right.
Like, if you can figure out that piece, even if you're not comfortable with it, is it better than what we've got? Because the alternative was always going to be hooked to what just passed this weekend.
Right.
And if you don't have anything hooked to it, it's just going to pass.
And if it's got 300 and something votes, it had 300 and something votes 2 months ago. And, you know, if you don't like the foreign aid, you can vote no. There's an old saying, vote no and take the dough. Because there are a lot of conservatives through the years who have fought to get pieces of conservative policy into bills that they didn't necessarily agree with because they use leverage. And I just feel like that was a lost opportunity here.
Yeah, just remember, an accomplishment is a yes vote. It doesn't mean that you don't vote no on a whole bunch of bad shit. I mean, hell, I was most of my career spent trying to block bad stuff in the United States Senate. So, I mean, I identify with all of that. But heroes are people who get yes votes on things that improve the country. Heroes are never people who say no to bad things that happen anyway. Right? I mean, that's just a fact. Mm-hmm. And I understand that this particular issue is extremely divisive. But if you're trying to do something on the border, if you're trying to do something about debt, if you're trying to do about all the things that you talk about being a champion of, you have to at some point get to yes in order to be a hero on something. Mm-hmm. And that may not be today. That may be when Donald Trump is president, God willing. But you're going to have to figure out how to get the yes, because a constant no vote doesn't get us any further down the road.
Yeah.
All right. So these Israel protests, I mean, this is the hilarious backdrop to all of this. The thing passes, you know, with 385 votes, 385 to 341. But the 34 that oppose this in the Democrat side, they've got a very vibrant constituency, as we have seen. Let's see clip number three, Spaghetti.
My check!
My check! Repeat after me!
We have
Zionists! We have Zionists! Who have entered the camp!
Who have entered the camp!
We are going to create a human chain!
We are going to create a human chain!
Where I am standing!
Where I am standing!
So that they do not pass this point!
They do not pass this point!
And infringe upon our privacy!
And try to disrupt our community.
I mean, privacy.
If that isn't just like the perfect example of like the sheep mindset that has essentially taken over the progressive movement, the left. I mean, look at these people. They're sheep.
It's like Fight Club meets Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they're just, like you said, total sheep, but also super dorky.
Super dorky. is that like in the middle of a quad or something, right? Like, it seems like a pretty public place, and they're like, my privacy!
My privacy! Well, go into your dorm and shut the fuck up, then. How about that for your privacy? Get online and look up, like, you know, suitcase bombs or whatever else that it is that you do in your free time. Those were protesters at Columbia University that wanted to keep a human chain to keep the Zionists out. Apparently, these are people who are anything but pro-Hamas are now Zionists. Clip number four, if we wouldn't mind, Spaghetti. This is going to be at Yale.
You're literally touching us.
I'm allowed to walk.
That's fine. Let me tell you something. He has three of them. I'm just trying to walk around. Let me walk around.
Well, then you can walk through us.
We're here.
Don't get in my way.
He's allowed to. This is insanity. This is insanity. These.
Imagine for a moment that that was a black student.
Yeah.
Just think about that. Try to process that for a second. That's an African-American student walking through a crowd of white people chanting at them and blocking their way. Do you think the National Guard would be at Yale? Does anybody think?
I mean, we have a history of it.
For one second that this wouldn't be a national emergency? But somehow the guy, so he's Jewish.
Right. So he's an oppressor.
And like what you're watching, if you're just audio only, is a guy, he literally just trying to walk through this.
Just down the sidewalk.
Courtyard and get through the people. And he's like pretty calmly dealing with it. It's incredible that this is going on.
Yeah.
Just incredible. I mean, meanwhile, Iran is launching missiles into Israel. I mean, we're all acting as though there's two sides to this fight.
Yeah, Hamas needs a safe space on college campuses.
Holy cats. It's just unbelievable. What they have done to poison the minds of people is just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Just incredible. Got one more clip for you. Clip 6, if you wouldn't mind.
Wait, what was that
sign? So that clip, for those who aren't watching on YouTube, first off, subscribe, watch YouTube. It's much better in video. But for those who are just listening, that was a pro-Israel rally, and then you had a pro-Hamas protester there holding up a sign. The Al-Qassam is the military wing of Hamas. They held up a sign saying Al-Qassam's next target with an arrow
towards the pro-Israel protesters.
Yeah.
Essentially saying Hamas.
Like, kill my fellow students. People.
Yeah.
Kill my fellow students.
And what was she with? She had like a dish rag wrapped around her face.
Jesus.
What was that mask?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's like.
I'm not familiar with the garments of Hamas.
Palestinian head of dish rag. Jesus.
Look at her. Get out of here. She's threatening to murder people just holding flags?
Yeah.
She doesn't deserve any respect.
That's the thing is, again, the mindset that has eaten the left like Duncan went into is like they see everything as oppressor and oppressed. They think every single human being should be judged by the color of their skin. Doesn't matter what you've accomplished, who you are, what you believe, you will always be one thing based on the color of your skin, ethnicity, nationality. And it's insanity because we spent decades in this country getting over that, and they want it back. Mm-hmm. I mean, you heard a couple of years ago, Columbia was proposing having separate graduation ceremonies for black students and white students, and they consider that progress.
It's just terrible.
It's disgusting. Listen to this, though. One of the protesters, according to NBC News, said, quote, "This is the moral thing to do." The person's name was Elliot, 25, still in school, evidently. who uses they, them pronouns.
A lot of they, thems in Gaza.
A lot of they, thems in Gaza.
Yeah, I'm sure they love that stuff.
That's the moral thing to do, Michael. Yeah. You go to college for a decade and you protest.
Well, I'm sure Elliot's like a doctor now. Yeah, right.
Right. Declined to give their last name in fear of retaliation. Yeah, no. Definitely when you call on the homicide of your fellow students, I can't imagine what you have to fear from anybody in charge of it.
If it's such a moral thing to do, why are you such a fucking coward?
Yeah.
Huh?
I mean, it's just so bad. I mean, the whole thing is shocking. It's shocking. And the reason that we keep on this stuff is because it's super important. It's just super important.
Can I give one positive outcome out of this? Mm-hmm. It says, this is from the article, it says, Isra Hirsi, the 21-year-old daughter of Rep. Ilhan Omar and a Barnard student, was among the more than 100 people arrested Thursday, according to police. Hirsi said on social media that she was suspended. And I saw this headline in the news where it said, Ilhan Omar's daughter is now suspended, homeless, and hungry.
Come on.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, oh,
come
wow.
on.
You know, it's
oh 2 days God. Later.
Yeah.
They
love just playing the victim.
Okay, well, like here are some of these victims. This is from the New York Daily News article on the Columbia University protests. One masked protester reportedly vowed to a group of Jewish students passing through campus to, quote, repeat October 7th 10,000 more times.
Ugh. Chilling.
And now these people are complaining that they're suspended from school. Get the fuck out of here.
They should be on a terror watch list.
Yeah.
They should be.
Yeah.
Well, so the New York Post is asking who these people are, and they have a headline that says the anti-Israel protests include Letitia James's intern, UPS executive's daughter, who killed an elderly couple in a crash as a teen.
Jesus.
The Ilhan person.
Yeah.
As you said, Ilhan Omar's daughter. They've got also cuffed and removed was Isabel Jennifer Seward. This was the daughter of the UPS executive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing is like so many of these people, it's like you're a congressman's daughter. Shut the hell up. You're not homeless.
Yeah,
get the hell out of here.
So what I love about this story is that you remember when we covered like who becomes a terrorist? We did this like 6 months ago or whatever. And I think what you see often in these cases is that with radical, you know, beliefs, they're really luxury beliefs of people who don't know what to do with their lives. And very often they're very well off. I mean, Osama bin Laden was very, very well off. Yep. He came from a family that had tons and tons of money. In that story from the New York Post, I'll just quote here from the article, a Post deep dive into the backgrounds of the protesters shows many list multi-million dollar mansions as their home addresses, according to sources, and come from wealthy and powerful families.
Yep. That's the thing. And that's something that really should be discussed, too, is, you know, there's been talk of, and I think rightfully so, seize the endowments of these places. Mm-hmm. Seize the endowments. It has to be done. The fact that these places have essentially turned into camps to train left-wing activists, violent ones now, straight-up violent left-wing activists, and that they get a skate on taxes, and we're bankrolling these people, these institutions of hate. And all these kids, spoiled brats, like Duncan said, luxury beliefs, a working-class kid, a middle-class kid, does not have time to chant, you're invading my privacy, let's form a human rope line, because they're probably working a second job to afford college.
Not only that, those are the people who are more likely than not to be on a ship sitting in the Persian Gulf waiting for all hell to break loose based on what they're doing.
They can use the GI Bill to go to college.
Yeah. I mean, so this last one I wanted to highlight, Mia Roque, a sophomore political scientist student at Barnard, belongs to the Columbia University College Democrats and recently attempted a lobbying trip to Washington, D.C. Her LinkedIn profile says she'll be working for Illinois Democrat Senator Dick Durbin as an intern this summer.
And he is just the worst.
I mean, that is really the scariest thing, is like these videos we've watched and how disgusting it is one thing. But this is the future of the Democratic
Party.
It's
integrated.
It's coming up.
We're not saying this to be provocative.
No, this is the farm system for the future of the Democratic Party.
This
and
is
it's
it.
Radical, and it's crazy, and it's pro-Hamas.
And all these news organizations are going to attempt to try to make it seem like this is just sort of a, well, weird counterculture college atmosphere. All of these people are signed up to be the next generation of
public
leaders on the Democratic
It's like the Weather Underground running for president someday.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen.
Well, we've seen that before, haven't we?
Wow. Yeah.
We've seen that before.
Yep. And we didn't do anything about it then.
Old Bill Ayers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Best friends with Barack Obama.
Palling around with terrorists.
That's right. Yeah. Should have went harder on that, to be honest with you.
Well, if we had it over to do again.
Yeah.
I think we probably Donald Trump wouldn't miss that shot.
Of course he wouldn't. That's why he became president and John McCain didn't.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right about that. All right, we got a couple things in Variety that we got to get to. Remember we talked about the this enhanced games, I think it's called?
Yes.
And you're a huge fan of this.
I am extremely, extremely excited. For folks who have missed out on our previous segment, so the enhanced games are going to basically be an Olympics where any kind of performance-enhancing drug is allowed, and every athlete competing will be under 24-hour watch from doctors, constantly monitoring their health. This is going to be done safely.
This is like as much juice as you can put in the veins without the heart exploding.
That's the thing. So, this is if we stop being artificially chained, right? Like, it would
artificially
be like,
chained.
Yeah. Like, you know, the
turning the argument around,
the thing,
that is just
the first marathon was run barefoot.
Mm-hmm.
But now you see him wearing in like the top of the line Nikes that'll, you know, give 1% energy back, and that's how you break 2 hours on a marathon now. Should we get rid of shoes? Humans make progress. And that's the same way.
Do they believe in the science?
That's the thing, is if you try to proclaim you trust the science. I don't trust the science, but I think it could be used for entertainment purposes.
Science is good for entertainment. Well, anyway, Rob McElhaney and Ridley Scott Associates set up a docuseries about the doping-friendly sports championship. That's the news. This was from Variety.com. So apparently this is going to be well documented.
So cool.
And we're going to be able to see all of this. Do we know when these things kick off? Because, like,
Next year?
Oh, we have a weird year to wait for this. Holy smokes, I don't know if I can wait.
Isn't next year also the Olympics in Paris?
No, that's this summer.
Is that this summer?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the real Olympics are next year.
And you're very consistent on this because you are a pro-doping horse.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
Across all...
Dope the horses, dope the athletes. And like I said, this should be just phase one. This is going to work well.
What's phase two?
Phase two is now you have the super athletes, you breed them. And then you have like you know, superhumans that are now competing for our entertainment, you know? It's like Pokemon. Like, you know, you do MMA, you make them fight each other. And then you find the ones who are the fastest and the best at kicking people. And then you breed them, you know? Then you end up with a super fighter, and then we keep this going. This would be a $1 trillion business if they execute it correctly.
Imagine what you're giving to your great grandchildren.
Yeah, and this is the thing, is like with MMA, you know, I remember years and years ago, people shy away from it. They'd be like, "Oh, UFC, it's too violent, it's too much." Look at it now. I mean, MMA has come a long way. People, the thing is, you know, the Romans understood this. People want bread and circus, right? They had their Colosseum. We don't have the Colosseum. You know, football's getting softer and softer every year.
Okay, so here's my next question. For phase three, would you introduce weapons to the octagon?
I think so. If they sign off on it.
Straight cockfight.
If they sign off on it, I think weapons should be allowed.
Like a sword, you have to choose. It's a limited number. You can't use a gun, obviously.
Yeah. I
although,
think,
like maybe a Hunger Games type activity within the games,
and
might actually
if everyone is a willing participant, I'd be fine with that too. And here's the thing: is everyone thinks, oh, that they try to act like they're squeamish or something about it, it would be the best selling pay per views of all time.
This docuseries I think will be incredible.
Seems like it.
I mean, you got Rob from Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh yeah,
and then Ridley Scott, who name it. You know, I mean,
yeah,
Napoleon.
Totally.
I mean, he did Gladiator.
Prometheus.
Well, he did Gladiator. He's got experience.
He knows it.
He gets it. What I'm curious, though, is this docuseries going to be more Always Sunny or more like, you know, Ridley
Yeah,
Scott?
Are we making fun? Are we laughing?
Are we laughing?
Or are we serious?
Are we serious? Which one?
And either way it pans out, I'm good.
Yeah. You know, I love documentaries. It's like one of my favorite nerd things.
Yeah.
Make fun of me.
No, I'm a big documentary guy myself.
But I've got one more recommendation for this. Like the voiceover work, they should hire Werner Herzog.
Oh, yeah, dude. Yes.
Like he could paint a picture with his words so well. And if he did this, I would watch the first midnight showing of it.
Dude, Ridley
that's
Scott,
a great idea.
Ridley Scott, if you're listening.
Please. Werner Herzog to do the voiceover. That would be so good.
That's the right call.
Yeah.
And also, I think the program could have a role here.
Yeah.
100%.
Don't you think? I mean, we'd do a great breakdown of tape after the game. I mean, can you imagine doing the side-by-sides? You know they do at the NFL Combine where it's like, here's the shadow of the fastest person to run it. And then here's the person running it.
I mean, you can break that down. I want
to
see him run 40s and everything. So then you can have just like a total comparison to what, you know, held back sports are compared to when we allow people to reach their true potential.
And then finally the world will understand how to trust the science.
There you go. This is how you do it.
Well, speaking of brave competitors... For those of you who are new to this, this happens every year. There is an annual hockey game between the New York Police Department and the Fire Department.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually pretty good. And like I think Barstool has basically taken a hold of this thing lately.
Nice.
Where they've promoted it and whatnot. But the way it plays out is there is some decent hockey being played, no question about it. But these fuckers love to fight.
Yeah.
I mean, they just love to fight.
It's like you show up to a fight and a hockey game broke out.
Yeah, yeah, which is an underappreciated aspect about hockey, no question about it. Can we play clip 7?
Demke's involved again. Right, he's turfing. He's involved.
See, look, like this can be confused real hot.
Okay.
And look at that.
Ooh. Wow.
Comes in with a cross check to the boards. Ooh. And then melee.
Now it's a brawl.
Melee.
And then, so for the folks who are listening, the entire teams, both of them rush, drop gloves, and start throwing hands.
Everyone is involved.
First responders behind the goal.
Look, there's a kid at the glass cheering.
Kid loves it.
Cross-check someone from behind. Here he comes.
Oh, yeah.
Two on one.
And this is terrific.
It is terrific. By the way, I love that the cops are wearing their traditional Irish green.
I mean, I can't get enough of that. That should be nationally televised.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Question. And it was unlike most hockey games. It sounds like it was actually a solid watch. 6-5 was the final score. Usually you watch a hockey score. Oh, 0-0, folks. Good night.
Yep. I mean, look, if you're in here for our entertainment, that is the kind of thing that you like to see. A full brawl on the ice. I love it. All right, so we got to get to our interview. Guys, I can't tell you enough how happy I am that he chose to come in here and do this. Said it was at the top of his board when he became chairman. We really appreciate that here in the Variety program. Take a listen. I want to welcome a very special guest to the program. He's got a very big job. You've read a lot about him lately. He's getting himself situated. It's been several weeks. RNC Chair Michael Whatley, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you guys. You know, I gotta start out by telling you, when I get in on day one, right? So I get elected on a Friday, Laura and I, and they give you the weekend, right? So we show up at Monday morning at 8 o'clock, and they're just standing here in front of this fire hydrant. Here's a straw. This won't hurt. So on Tuesday, we're kind of going through all of the requests that have come in, and I tell the guys, I'm like, look, I hate reactive scheduling. I want proactive scheduling. I want to make sure that we know what we need to do and then schedule accordingly, right? Yeah. So we're sitting there and we've got this big whiteboard and they're like, okay, well, what do you want to do, right? So we kind of divide it up into political and then press, media kind of things, and then fundraising and else. So we get on to media and I was like, Ruthless Podcast.
Yes!
That's right.
And they were like, really? I was like, first thing, Ruthless Podcast. It is on there. It is circled.
So I love
it. We're filling that out now. And everybody's like, okay, we'll make it happen.
I love it.
It's good to be on with you guys.
Immediately got his priorities entirely straight from our standpoint. Well, listen, this is new to you in being the chairman of the RNC. This is not new to you overall. I mean, you spent a lot of time in this line of work, figuring out how to turn North Carolina into a reliably red state when forever everybody was telling us it was tipping blue. That part of it, you've kind of gotten figured out over the years.
Yeah, we have. You know, and North Carolina is a great microcosm for everything we're dealing with, right? It's 30% Republican, 33% Democrat, 37% unaffiliated. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to win, you got to get your base, right? You got to be persuading the folks in the middle. And you can't be crazy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you think about Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Georgia, they're a lot like it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all about a third with unaffiliated Republicans and Democrats. And you really, truly need to run two separate campaigns. Number one, you got to get your base out. You got to turn out the vote. And then you got to persuade the folks in the middle. And you know, so when we look at this election cycle, it really is a pretty good setup for what we're trying to get done.
Yeah, no question about it. And your reputation has been terrific, both in RNC circles and just Republican politics writ large. I imagine at the beginning of the cycle, you didn't anticipate this being your gig.
No, not at all. I mean, I had locked in. You know, I ran North Carolina as a senior advisor for the Trump campaign in 16. And then I was the chair in the 2020 cycle. I came on board in 19. And so really was not planning on running again for chair. I mean, 4 years is a long time.
Yeah.
But then you look at the campaign and the conversations I was having with, you know, President Trump and his team and others, and they're like, we got to win this state. You got to stay here. So, yeah, just basically run it in for the third time and make sure we deliver the state again. And we've got a big governor's race and the congressional mm-hmm. races down there. But I was general counsel. You know, Ron had asked me to come in as general counsel. So was really working on setting up the National Election Integrity Program and really helping on the national scene a bit. But no, when Ron called and said, hey, I think I'm going to step aside here, you need to look at this, that was a pretty surprising call.
Yeah.
So, I have a question right along the lines of what you've been discussing. So you have had tremendous success in North Carolina, the control that the Republicans have over the state legislature, both Senate seats. We want to win that governor's race this cycle. What lessons did you learn from your time in locking up those Republican wins in North Carolina that you think you're going to carry nationwide as RNC chair?
Good. Two things, right? Really, really two things. You know, and when you're typically the RNC chair gets in and they've got 2 years, you kind of get a year to run around the country and meet a bunch of people and make a bunch of friends and raise a bunch of money. And with this, it was, you know, you got 7 months, go, right?
Right.
But the lessons are really, truly, we don't have time to be all things to all people, right? We really only have time to do two things. We are going to get out the vote and we're going to protect the ballot.
Yeah.
And everything that we do is going to focus on get out the vote programs, and then it's going to focus on election integrity programs. And I like that. I like that a lot because it is clarity, you know, and it really every single day we're going to be driving on this. Now, we've got a communications function that's really important. What are we going to talk about?
Oh, you're communicating.
Getting out
right
the vote.
Yeah. Very effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and we've got fundraising. Why are we fundraising? What are we going to spend the money on?
Yeah.
Getting out the vote, protecting the ballot. You know, I'll tell you a funny story. I was having breakfast with President Trump, and right around the time when the vote was going to take place, and we're you know, small talk and everything, and he said, "All right, Wadley, what's the plan? How are we going to do this?" And I said, "Sir, we're going to do two things. We're going to get out the vote. We're going to protect the ballot." So we talked kind of through those things. And we get done with the breakfast, we get done with the conversations, and we stand up, and I thought we'd moved on. And he looks at me, he goes, "All right, Michael, tell you what, I'll get out the vote, you protect the ballot."
Yeah.
You know, okay. It really comes down to that election integrity thing. But the all of the programs that we're building, right? So we've got Bank Your Vote.
Yeah.
We've got a Build Your Vote program that really is focused on low propensity voters and then bringing in minority voters and folks that we've never looked at before. Those are hugely important. And then on the election integrity side, that is all day, every day, the program we're building. And I think we're going to be exactly where we need to be on that. But those really are the lessons from North Carolina that are going to apply in Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, you know, Michigan,
so
Minnesota, and others.
On the Bank Your Vote,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's obviously very important that Republicans get out the vote early and through, you know, absentee or early in person. And I saw Donald Trump put out that Truth Social post about voting early, and I think, you know, it's incredibly important. I think for our audience, can you explain how important it is? Because a lot of people talk about it but don't know how substantial it is in our election.
Well, it's critical, yeah. Right? I mean, 50% of all voters are going to vote before Election Day this year. And that includes Republicans and it includes the independents, the unaffiliateds, right? Mm-hmm. Undecideds. And you have to talk to those people before they go vote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you cannot have a bunch, you know, and we used to, once upon a time, everybody remembers the 72-hour program?
Yeah,
right. Okay,
well, yeah.
So we would all deploy to Ohio or Florida or wherever. It's 72 hours out the Saturday, Sunday, Monday before the election. We can't do that anymore, right? We used to target all of our mail drops to go out the Saturday and hit the Saturday before the election. What 50% of the people have already voted? You're wasting half your money,
yeah.
Right? So what we need to do, and I set this program up in North Carolina in 2019 for the first time. We built an early vote program down there to make sure that we're getting people on the front end because we want them to be informed voters when we go in there. And we worked a lot with Congressional Leadership Fund and the Senate Leadership Fund and the RNC, NRCC, NRSC to try and make sure that all of those programs are targeting earlier. You know, Virginia, 45 days of early voting.
Mm-hmm.
North Carolina, we're only 17, right?
Yeah.
You know, but the mail programs are going out earlier just to make sure that we're hitting those. The it's critical for you to get the votes in, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that's nice, and this is a very nice ancillary, is that once a person votes either by mail or early, we can take them off our list. I don't have to send any more doors,
saving money,
any more phone calls, any more mail to that household. We can kind of check that box. We had, it was great. We had one lady who was just yelling at us, you know, last cycle about, God, you guys call me every single day. I said, ma'am, if just you just go vote, we'll stop calling.
Right. There's an easy answer to all of that. I mean, I can't tell you how refreshing it is to hear that from you. We've been preaching this up one side and down the other. It's also nice to have somebody who's actually done it and been a part of successful programs in North Carolina. Before we get into any more nuts and bolts on that, I want to know a little bit more about you, right? I mean, we know you're a North Carolina guy. We know your history in politics, and you've been incredibly successful in that. Growing up, like, did you know you're a politically interested person?
I was, you know, and it is funny. People ask, you know, when did you become a Republican? It was January 20th, 1981. Right. So I'm 12 years old and I'm watching Ronald Reagan's
inauguration.
And, you know, I was like, you know, aware that there was an election between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter and jelly beans versus, you know, pistachio cake. But all of a sudden they cut away from his speech to show the Iranian hostages being released. It was the first time I ever saw a split screen. Mm-hmm. Right. And I thought, oh, man, I'm with this guy.
Yeah.
You know, peace through strength. And honestly, when you talk about where we are today, it really matters. Peace through strength matters. Mm-hmm. Holy cow, is it important with it. So, yeah, I mean, I was a Republican growing up in Western North Carolina, which is an easy place to be a Republican.
Yeah, easier than other parts.
Absolutely,
for sure.
You know, and it was the first time I did when I was in law school at Notre Dame. And so my second summer, rather than get a job with a big firm, I got an internship with Jesse Helms. Mm-hmm. And so I came to D.C. and totally got the bug, right? So I graduate. I did a clerkship with a federal judge in Charlotte. I spent 1 year with a law firm. I call them elevator lawyers. You know, they're in the 35th floor of some tower. And I was like, this, no, absolutely not. And I got, you know, ended up getting a job with Paul Coverdell to work on the Senate floor. And we were running the floor for Trent Lott at the time. And just absolutely the coolest job I've ever had was – like working on the floor, you know, of the Senate and seeing policy get made for real.
Yeah.
And, you know, never look back.
And understanding the significance of elections when you see the policy being made in direct respect to how these outcomes of these elections are ultimately unfolded, right?
Yeah. I mean, it makes such a tremendous difference that you know, we spend a lot of time in primaries talking about good versus perfect. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, at the RNC, we adopt whoever comes out of the primary with an R next to their name. I get it. But you can't govern if you don't have a majority. Yeah. If you don't have a gavel, you're not gonna schedule the hearings.
Yeah.
You know, and so we look at this election cycle. You know, I mean, we've got, you know, a 50 Senate, we got a 50-50 House, we've got a presidency that's been decided, you know, by 44,000 votes last cycle, you know, nationwide. This entire country is going to go one way or the other here with this election cycle. I mean, as an academic, you look at a cycle like this and think, this is amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As somebody who's in the middle of it, where else would you want to be?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then absolutely in the middle of this, being able to say, hey, I'm going to make a difference and we're going to win, as opposed to if we're not here, we may not win.
Yeah. Well, we're glad that you're the guy in the middle of this. And I want to go back to the two things that you said that your priorities this time. So you talked a little bit about turning out the vote and about early vote. I want to ask you about protecting the ballot, because there are so many people who are concerned about what happened in 2020. And I'm just wondering if you could tell our listeners some of the things you're doing differently to try to improve the voter integrity this time around.
Yeah, big time. You know, so it's interesting. The RNC for 40 years was not able to do election integrity, which sounds crazy, right? But we were under a court order from a federal judge in Pennsylvania who said that we could not do election integrity. And so there was always left up to the state party or the presidential campaigns. And so in the presidential campaigns, it was always called EDO, Election Day Operations. Mm-hmm. Yep. And we'd go find lawyers and we'd have them run around to the precincts and make sure they weren't bussing people in. And we'd have a war room for people to call in if they had problems. But it was really just focused on that one day, right? So, you know, I learned election integrity 2000, right? So the 2000 election comes 2 days later. I got a call at 2 a.m. and they said, hey, we need you at Reagan Airport at 5 a.m. You're going to be on a plane going to Florida. We're going to have a recount. And so I was one of the lawyers down there, Broward County, which was the only county that actually finished the recount, right? We had, you know, some 400 attorneys that we brought down for the thing. And I promise you, if we were not there, they would have stolen that election.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the dimple chads and the tape chads and looking up at the mm-hmm. ballots and everything, they would have absolutely positively stolen that election if we weren't there. So when I took over as a state party chair in 19, I was like, we're building out this program mm. in North Carolina. We're going to recruit 500 attorneys for all 100 counties. And everybody in that state looked at me like I had two heads. They're like, what in the world are you talking about? We don't even have 500 Republican attorneys. So we did. Like, I hired a chief counsel. I was the only party in the entire country that hired a chief counsel. And then we had two interns, and they literally got on the phone every day and called Republican attorneys. We had 570 of them, I think, in the first election.
Excellent.
And we were there, right? And, yeah. you know, I really think when you think about election integrity, there are two things that you got to do. On the front side, on the front end, you have to have the rules of the road set up the right way.
There you go.
Right? You've got to know what they are, yeah. but you've got to be able to shift them. On, you know, voter ID, right? We didn't have voter ID in North Carolina when I took over. We have voter ID now,
yeah.
right? And you've got to have absentee or mail-in ballot protections for signatures, yeah. for witnesses. You got to make sure that they're actually doing it, right? Mm-hmm. We don't like ballot harvesting, but if you're going to do it, we want to make sure that we participate. You know, things like not letting non-citizens vote,
right? Mm-hmm.
Right? And making sure that you have, you know, only citizens voting. You know, there's a ton of different things that you have to have in place. But you got to have that in place before we get going, right? So we're working right now with secretaries of state, with boards of elections, with governors, with legislators to make sure that we're changing the rules to be the right rules of the road. That's really critical. And then you have to be in the room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this was the biggest thing I got out of kind of the Florida recount. You got to be in a room when people are voting. You got to be in a room when people are counting. Right. And so we set it up in North Carolina. We had 11,000 grassroots volunteers that signed up to do shifts on election day, 25,000 shifts, all 100 counties.
Yeah.
We had 500 attorneys plus that were out there, you know, making sure that everything was done the right way. And we didn't have a problem.
Yeah.
Right. Ohio and Florida were the other two that really kind of did yeah. the same things. Right. So coming out of 20, we were, as a RNC, kind of like everybody thinking, oh my God, what just happened,
right?
And so when we sat down, I had a conversation with Ronna McDaniel and the others there of what went right, what went wrong. And it was real easy for us to look at the states where it was done right and the states that didn't,
mm-hmm.
and to say, what's the difference here? And the difference is, did you have attorneys? Did you have good rules of the road? And were you in the room?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? So we built an election integrity committee that did a six-month review and a study. Really, really good. Like, it's on the RNC website. I tell everybody to go take a look at it. But if you look at the recommendations for the states, it looks a lot like what, you know, the states who had done it
right.
had done. And then in 22, we kind of built a program at the RNC to like do it, because now we can do it, right? The judge who for 40 years said you can't do election integrity died. So thankfully we were able to get another judge who said, wait a minute, what?
You know,
and they got rid of that, right? So we built the program at the RNC, and it really was kind of a cross between our political shop and our election legal shop to kind of build these things out there with varying degrees of success. Some states wanted to do it, some states, you know, were like, we're okay. No problem. So we had kind of mixed results in it as we were going into it. And when Ronna asked me to be the general counsel, it really was, I need you to build this out.
Yeah.
I need other states to do what you did, and we've got to have this done nationwide. And the urgency is very real.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, we cannot have what happened in 20 happen in 24. Mm, it cannot ever happen again, right? So now, you know, that I'm in as the chair and we're talking to these states, and I've been to Arizona, I've been to Georgia, I've been to, you know, Milwaukee, I've been up to Philadelphia and met with the Pennsylvania GOP. We're talking to those guys, and we're saying you have to build these types of programs out there. And various states have always done pretty good jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Pennsylvania, the legal team that they've had up there has really always been very, very, very good. But now we need to put the people in the room.
Yeah.
And we need to make sure that we're in there on election day. We need to be there for the early voting. We need to be there when they're counting those votes. You just got to be in the room, you know.
I just want to underscore how good that answer is.
Yep.
Because, perfect. Look, in today's day and age, there are a whole bunch of people who think they know a lot about politics and how to win elections and whatnot. And it's usually some social media-driven discussion of, you know, who's doing you wrong and who. What you just described is exactly the way that you win elections, protecting the ballot and getting out the vote. That is it. Mm-hmm. That's it. I mean, if the four of us spent the next hour discussing everything, you just distilled it down into the last 4.5 minutes of exactly what needs to be to happen here. Mm-hmm. Don't you think, fellas?
Yeah.
I mean, just thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. You're off to a terrific start. All right. So everybody that we bring in here,
right,
we ask some questions. But the first one, and you're not going to know this one is coming because it's not the three. We also have taken a great interest in the animal menace that is crossing our country right now. And
it's
by
it's
what
a big
we
problem.
What we mean by the animal menace, there are wild animals that are attacking, like wild bears robbing people.
Yeah, monkeys in Thailand.
Monkeys
yeah.
in Thailand.
You had a dog killed its owner. You had a hog killed its butcher. I mean, it's a problem all over the world.
And I saw a headline out of North Carolina where there was these two people recovering from a rabid fox. And so, Smash, you always have a question that you ask all of our significant guests.
So my question is, thinking about this rabid fox and what it's done to some of the residents of the great state of North Carolina, it's not the only dangerous animal in that state. And I'm just wondering, thinking back through all your time you spent driving around, what is the biggest animal that you think you could take mano a mano?
Bare hands.
That's a tough call. Yeah. That's a tough call.
I mean, I know where you're from, right? So you right. can kind of like narrow yeah. it down. I mean, there's probably been animal combat in your history.
Well, look, I think the one that I've had the most direct impact with, mm-hmm. literally, are the deer. You know, when I took over the NCGOP, you know, I had 69,000 miles on my truck. Yeah. And I now have like 444,000 miles on
still
my
running,
truck.
Huh?
It is still running. Wow. Engine number 2, transmission number 3.
Wow.
Deer collisions, you know, are up there.
On the regular.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Do you ever throw it in the back and have it wake up halfway?
You know, I can't go there.
We're going to take the 5th on all of that. All right. I'll get into the ones that you know are coming. So if you can plan your last meal on Earth, and again, I think Smug's probably got more rigorous oversight on this, yep. being from a North Carolinian background. If you could plan your last meal on Earth, what would it be?
So I'm gonna give you two caveats that it's not, right? So the barbecue has to be vinegar-based Eastern North Carolina barbecue.
Okay.
And
that's
I'm
the right
all
answer.
About that, right?
That's the right answer.
And I know everybody comes in here and says, oh, it's got to be the steak, right? My problem is if it's the last meal, I know they're going to burn it. And I would be bitter. I'm not going to go there. So
I love the healthy disdain for they, by the way.
Yeah.
And this because you're going down.
It would be cooked medium, and I would just not be able to take that. So for me, it's 3 eggs over medium, whole wheat toast, and liver mush.
Oh, liver.
We're going wow. for breakfast, yeah.
Liver mush. Wow. That's a new one. I don't think we've had that one before.
Wow. What goes into a liver mush?
You know, it's a southern sausage. It's a breakfast sausage that they cook down there. In Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Delaware, they call it scrapple.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But,
oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's better
you guys call
south.
It liver mush.
Yeah.
You know okay. what? I'm with them on this. I love that.
Yeah.
It is so flavorful. If you haven't tried it, there's a reason why he's saying this should be his last meal. It's very, very flavorful.
And honestly, you could turn it into a breakfast sandwich if you want, but it's perfect to go.
Smash, in Ohio, they call that geta?
Well, geta has oats.
Geta has oats.
Yeah, so it's a little different.
Okay. But
it's always some kind of weird thing.
A regional dialect for each and everyone. Okay, so second question. Given that you've dedicated so much of your career to public service, getting the right people in place to have policy that sort of we all agree would be in the betterment of our country, you now have the opportunity to look back on a lot of that. And if you're just given blue sky, you look back and you could fill it with absolutely anything based on your life's experiences, and you could pick anything to do, what would it be?
I would own a professional baseball team.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
And I would go to 162 games a year.
Yes.
And I would get to see all of the country and all of the sights and have a great hot dog every night and enjoy a game.
See, this is the guy that gets that question.
Yeah, right.
So many times we ask them, like, you know, I don't think I'd do anything different. I just love my family and I love what I do. And it's like, yeah, I know that. That's why you've chosen your life. But, like, if you could do anything... Professional baseball.
Absolutely.
Team.
You know, I last year, my New Year's resolution was that I was going to listen to all 162 Braves games.
Oh.
Right? So I got the MLB.com app,
yeah.
free promo there. and it was like when I was in my truck driving around the state,
yeah.
I could go back and make it up. I could do it. When I was up here in D.C., I could watch it on the TV.
Yeah.
But I got all 162 games
you
in
did?
For the first time in my life. It was awesome.
Terrific.
I mean, it's a pretty good team to watch, too, to be honest with you. They could be the World Series champions this year.
They should be.
Yeah. All right. So our third question, and this is the esoteric question about everyone that we think is, you know, sort of successful in life is motivated by one of two things: the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. The thrill of victory, nobody doesn't like to win, but it's sort of the glass half full type optimist who's, I relate to, like Phil Mickelson. When he knows that he should lay up, but he's hit the two iron 300 yards before, and he feels like, well, I've hit the shot, I should do it again. And the agony of defeat side is always the Michael Jordan character, North Carolinian guy, who, you know, every championship he celebrated for like 3.5 minutes, but every time you insulted him on the way in the court, he wore it like a backpack for the rest of his life, right? So those are the two poles. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, where do you find yourself?
So interesting. What I would say is I pick my directions, I pick my projects, I pick where I'm going based on absolutely we're playing offense, we're going
yeah.
all the time, right? But then when you get into it, it is absolutely the fear of failure.
Yes.
It drives you 100%. Yeah. I mean, I can assure you nobody picked Donald Trump in 2015 thinking, oh yeah, we're going to win this thing. But
yeah.
I did, right? It was like, because this is the guy and we can win this thing.
Yeah.
Right? So it was all about that playing offense. But then when you're in it and you're, you know, you're the RNC chair, right? And it's, I mean, nothing big. It's just the fate of the country and the world, on, you know, whether we win this election or not.
Right.
You live in abject fear every day of, okay, I got to do this, right?
Yeah.
Do I need to make these 5 more phone calls? Yes.
Right.
I need to make these 5 more phone calls. Do I really need to fly here to tape the Ruthless Podcast and then get on a plane to go to Houston? Yes.
Indeed.
Absolutely I do, right?
Great use of
yeah.
time.
And we're you know, you really, truly have to understand what happens if we don't get this done.
Yeah.
And that is an unbelievable driver.
That is an yeah. agony defeat guy right
yep.
there, and
yep.
you're sitting amongst them here. So I get
yeah.
it. It's funny how that splits two ways, but I would rather have somebody running the party with a healthy feel of fear of failure than anything else.
And, and lawyers typically are always agony of defeat.
Yeah.
Right. always, because right. they're thinking about, you know, I got to like have a case here before, and then maybe I have a, you know, a client and they're going to go to prison if I don't get this right, you know?
Before I get you out of here, you mentioned your early adoption of the Trump campaign, Donald Trump. Do you remember when that sort of occurred with you? And like, when was the first time you met him?
So I got a call in November of 15 from Trump Tower, Corey Lewandowski, saying, and this is great, right? So he calls and he says, Wiley, we need you to run Virginia for Donald Trump. And I said, well, I can't. And he's like, well, what? Are you with somebody else? I said, no, I can't. Well, why not? I said, well, I just moved to North Carolina 6 weeks ago. Wiley, we need you to run North Carolina for Donald Trump.
An easy pivot. An easy pivot. I love it.
Okay. I don't know anybody here, but we're on it, right? You know, and look, I think, you know, we did, you know, first time I met him was March of 16. We were doing a rally
yeah.
Down in Greensboro. And I get this call. Hey, do you know anything about running rallies? Yeah, I can run a rally. Great. We're going to bring President Trump down there in 10 days. Can you go find a venue?
And he has just itty-bitty rallies, too.
Oh,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, easy logistics.
They're just doing it in a coffee shop.
We threw it together in the Greensboro Coliseum.
Yeah,
and,
I was going to say, you'd need a Coliseum.
9,500 people later, and we got fire marshaled, you know, and it was just, we're off and running. But
you're not trying hard enough if you're not fire marshaled.
Absolutely.
I love that. All right, so for all of the listeners who want to get involved, whether it's through the modern-day EDO programs that you guys have set up or your Get Out the Vote stuff, ballot integrity, what have you, where do they go?
Two websites. First is protectthevote.com. Mm-hmm. That is for you to sign up to be part of the election integrity team, to be an observer. We will get you into any different state that you want to go to, right?
Okay. Excellent.
And then GOP.com for anything else. And
yeah.
obviously, if you go to GOP, you can find Protect the Vote. But, you know, we are really right now hitting a stride. It is remarkable to see the enthusiasm across the country. You know, we went down to Georgia for a couple of events last week. We pulled into a Chick-fil-A. Vine City.
Yeah.
Right? Atlanta.
Not exactly a base of Republican Democrat.
94% black, 94% registered Democrat, 97% for Joe Biden. We walk into the Chick-fil-A, he was absolutely mobbed. They had lines out the door, and people were just hugging on him and kissing on him.
I saw a video. It was incredible.
I mean, it was absolutely unbelievable. And, you know, we're seeing that type of enthusiasm everywhere we go. And it really, truly matters, because this is going to be an election season where we've got to get people up. We've got to get people enthusiastic. There are two records. You know, Donald Trump's 4 years, Joe Biden's 4 years. You can look at the difference on any number of issues, and it's going to make a big difference. But I think there's a very visceral reaction right now to the people who are seeing Donald Trump show up at these events at a bodega in downtown New York and get mobbed, at a Chick-fil-A, you know, and get mobbed, or any of the other events we do, versus when Joe Biden walks into, you know, an arena and there the circles on the floor,
honking cars. Well, everybody can have a lot of confidence in your chairmanship. You're saying all the right things, and I know you're already off to a great start. Thank you for taking some time out of your busy schedule to join us here on Ruthless.
Thank you, guys. Welcome back
anytime.
We'll do it. We'll absolutely do it. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I love this guy.
Yeah.
There's nothing not to like. I mean, he is traveling the country. He is raising money. He's doing everything that you're supposed to do as a chairman. And his answers to these questions, I really hope people were paying attention, because he has programs that will set us up to win.
And I think we emphasized this sort of in the interview, but you, for those of us who do this for a living and have spent an awful lot of time trying to get it right, his answers on this are not a made-for-TV answer. It's a real answer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, what he's talking about is actually the way that you solve all these problems as they deal with voter integrity, early vote, making sure you're banking ballots, all of those things. And it just gives me great comfort to know that you've got a guy whose hand is on the wheel, who's done it successfully, as you pointed out, in North Carolina, and is willing to put himself forward and basically give over his life for the next 6 months to give us our best shot to win in November.
I think that's the thing, is this isn't someone who's just trying to say what people want to hear. This is someone describing what they've already done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I cannot tell people enough the record of success in North Carolina of what they've accomplished at the state level, getting voter ID done.
Yeah.
And now you have the guy who's gotten all of that done to do it nationally. I mean, right person at the wheel, person at the wheel.
Totally agree. So anyway, take comfort in that. Help out if you can, too. He gave some links there. And if you're interested in being part of the solution, that is definitely a place I would go, because you can trust the folks over there to get you into the right spot. All that being said, fellas, I think on a Tuesday, we've done it.
I think so. Absolute banger of an episode, gentlemen. Thanks again, Chairman Whatley, for coming by for that interview. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, if you have not yet, go to that YouTube and subscribe. So until next time, minions, keep the faith, hold the line, and own the libs. We'll see you on Thursday. Stay ruthless.